Feinfühlig, der Podcast zu digitaler Kulturforschung. Ein Institutskolloquium für die Ohren.
This is by no means an even playing field. So who gets blocked? Well, drag queens. Cosplayers who are persons of color. So I think we need not one virtual ethnography, I think we need different methods for these different platforms.
Im Gespräch mit Nicole Lamerichs über Fan Studies, Affordanzen, Plattformen und Netzwerke. Hello everybody, my name is Damaris Müller and my guest today is Nicole Lamerichs. Since Nicole is from the Netherlands, today's episode will be in English. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. Yeah, Nicole Lamerichs. I'm a senior lecturer at Creative Business at an applied university in Utrecht. What I studied for my bachelor was cultural studies, and for my master I did sociology of technology, a specific master more with an SDS focus in Maastricht. And then I did my PhD, which was on fan studies. And now I teach a lot of different courses, some of them also more in the area of new technology, AI, blockchain, a few things around participatory culture. So keeping myself busy.
Your book, Productive Fandom, is a study on intermediality and effective reception in fan cultures. What do you think? What is it we can learn from fans?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I've always been fascinated by fans. I think they're very interesting audiences, very active. I was also involved in fandom myself. And definitely in the Netherlands, there weren't that many studies on this. In the Anglo-American studies I'd read, I missed a lot of things, right? So I missed things like attention to cosplay. I missed attention to material fandom and objects. I missed more insights into crafting. I mean, a lot of people sometimes call fan studies jokingly fan fiction studies. Yeah. But I think that there is some truth to that, that a lot of the field gravitated around that, or it would gravitate around to slightly bigger questions that, for instance, convergence culture by Henry Jenkins points out. So I felt, well, there's a need for other things in that literature as well around narratives, characters, materiality. And I think in a lot of different disciplines, whether you're in cultural studies, literary studies, media studies, you can learn a lot from fans, from how they engage in reception, from the repertoires they use, the communities they build, but also because they're very active audiences. Yeah, of course, I'm someone who's often between the digital and offline, which is also what I kind of prefer. I do think digital fandom today is maybe entering a new age where it can even tell us a lot about algorithms. It can tell us a lot about AI, narrow AI. It can tell us a few things about new business models potentially. So there's a lot happening that I think is super, super fascinating, and that we should be exploring that much, much more.
Those are important aspects for sure, yeah. I liked your mixed methods approach, and especially that you didn't stick to fanfics, because it's, as you said, most research on fandom is indeed about fanfiction. What I really liked is that you went into the digital as well as the more traditional field. For example, you went to conventions, you studied cosplay, but you also got to digital roleplay. And I think that opened really a bigger picture. So analyzing your research, you had a key concept, and your key concept was intermediality. Could you give us a definition of intermediality?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's more theoretically, I would say it's about the transfer of media content from one medium to another, in terms of form, in terms of content, in terms of tropes or styles. more broadly speaking, or more, generally, I think intermediality is really the study of media content as it moves between different platforms and how different types of content and narratives might draw from each other, right? And that can go both ways, right? Something new, a new medium like a video game, might be inspired by something old, like a novel or the formatting of that. Simultaneously, an older format like a newspaper might draw from innovations that we see online. So it might draw from tweets or short formats or blogs. So intermediality often goes both ways, right? So it's always a process of remediation. And if you'd ask me, for me, it's always the study of media on the move. So I make very little distinction, though I do find that interesting and I do a bit of it in my book, but I'm not that obsessed with debates about, is this done intertextual or is this done transmedia or is this done blah, 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 or is this maybe remedia? Like, I think they're very similar forms. And for me, I always understand text and textuality in a broad sense. I see medium really as a lot of different things, from fabrics to skin to different technologies and platforms.
I think that allows for a closer focus on actors, on objects, on materialism. However, I wonder where the concept of intermediality has its limits. If everything is a text, then almost everything gets intermedial. Well, when I study fandom, I feel that everything is in an intermedial space or is intermediated, that everything is transformative, and I struggle with that.
I understand that. Yeah, I understand it, and I had some of that too. So even though I still find these kind of studies interesting, I also had a moment where I was like, this is not productive anymore. But I had a grant on intermediality, you have to understand. So I had to sit it out, right? And they were very clear, no, and it also shouldn't be only transmedia, Nicole, because your grant is on intermediality. Okay. I think it's a question at some point we all reach. And then the big other question is, hey, guys, in this time and age, are we not simply doing media studies? And I do think it partly is that, because a lot of things today, well, what isn't intermedial, right? So indeed, for that reason, I also moved a lot more lately to studies and concepts that are a bit more networked, a bit more post-structuralist, that are a bit more about agency and who the agency belongs to, who in that complex network of texts and interfaces, you know, how these different actors shape and affect each other. And I think also that's probably the way to do intermediality in an interesting way. If you're going to stick to the concept, and I sometimes, obviously I'm still in a lot of books that are about inter or transmediality and fandom. But then I also take a bit of that approach of, well, we have this whole network of texts, but this is by no means an even playing field, right? So you have to, I think, go beyond the purely narrative thing of, oh, this narrative borrows blah, blah, blah from another thing. No, you, I think, have to push further. But what does that then mean? And where do new forms of equality, inequality happen? Where do interfaces and platforms shape the way a fan fiction looks? Because that's also a really important one. And I do think in this complex platform economy that we're in, the platforms do have so much effect on how we do our posts, how we do our fan fiction, how we do, our new formats. If you look at TikTok now, for instance, you see new fan practices emerge. Why? Because it's a short video format with new types of vlogging emerging there. So that's where it's now, for instance, happening. And yes, fan scholars, we need to keep trend watching that. And parallel to that, I think we really need to think critically about the concepts we use and what they imply. Also taking into account, again, even though today's media culture is very intermedial, this also is nothing that new in history of narratives, right?
So to get to know you a little bit better, we've prepared some quick questions and I would read them and I'd ask you to answer them.
Oh yeah, the quick question. Oh my God, yes!
Name an important book during your PhD studies.
Yeah, I'm assuming you mean fiction. So then it's for me always, I think The Last Unicorn. There's a movie of it and a really nice animation film and a book. That's the original thing. And I love both. And I also met the author of that book when doing field research at OtaCon. And it's, yeah, very meaningful story. Each time I read it, I see something new in it because it is about aging. So the older you get, the more this novel is like, oh shit, it's resonating even more this time.
Name a theorist you would share a flat with.
Only one? Yeah, I think probably Karen Barat, because that's someone I feel I could learn a lot from with a different, very critical mindset. So I'd be very curious. But if it can be several and we can have a friends type of setup, I'd probably want to chill with people from different disciplines in one apartment, not only fan scholars, because I'd probably get annoyed and exhausted talking fans and fan studies the whole day. So I love unwinding a little bit as well. So I guess I'd probably want like a game scholar in and a Japanese studies scholar, a comic scholar, you name it. I just want a bunch of diverse people and together we have fun. Yeah.
Early fan studies often call fandom a democratic space. I think there's some truth to it. On the other side, most fans nowadays are on the big social media platforms, and they are certainly not democratic spaces. They are business owned by huge companies, Facebook, Twitter. Well, for example, in 2018, just before I started my own research, Tumblr updated its guidelines and banned all adult content. To me, fans refer to it as a purgatory, and many of them wandered off to different platforms. And I wonder if ANT could be useful to get a better understanding of what is happening.
Yeah, I definitely sometimes use actor network theory, but I'm also prone to things that go a bit further. Let's say Karen Barat's work, things like this, I'm drawn to more and more. Yeah, I think ANT can be a super great way to get started. So this kind of Latourian framework, bit, you know, material semiotic, though Latour probably wouldn't call it semiotic at all. But yeah, I think that's a fantastic starting point to think like this. Yeah, and I think that that can be one productive way of going about it. And what I like about such methods, so they allow for agency between different actors, potentially even fictional actors, right? Like characters. You can look a bit more at the different platforms. And so such a networked approach, indeed, it allows for different actors to emerge, and you can compare them more easily and map it out, which can be, I think, really interesting. And then you can indeed see how do different fan practices, characters, stories, how do they move between these nodes and influence each other? And it allows you, I think, to unpack these platforms a bit more in a nuanced way, because these are not, you know, one entity. No, these are different affordances, algorithms, spaces, types of content. So people are creating their own little networks, economies, you name it. And that's, yeah, super fascinating to look at.
Yeah, so there is this fan discourse going on, and it's roughly speaking about what should be allowed in fandom. For example, does the old verdict of don't like, don't read still apply? Can fans write whatever they want, or should they address racism? Should they talk about homophobia? And those questions led me to affordance. And what you just said really gives me a lot to think about. And it seems like a good way to get a understanding of those platforms. Because fans are not alone in their own space. They are on it's different platforms with from different companies. It's with many, many people from different countries and different cultures. And so fans aren't alone in their space. And also being on these big social media platforms means that other people come across the fan content. And this seems to lead to harassment, maybe. There is for sure a lot of harassment on Twitter, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you mentioned something really interesting here in a sense that, yeah, different platforms facilitate that in different ways, have different goals, have different guidelines. And indeed, sometimes these are mobilized to harass other people, right? Or sometimes these lead to erasure. Twitch, for instance, I've been working on a study on cosplaying on Twitch, and those guidelines, which for instance also stipulate things like what clothing you can wear or how scarce you can be in terms of clothing. So they have a whole nudity clause, but people often use that to troll or engage in racist behavior to other fans. So who gets blocked? Well, drag queens or cosplayers who are persons of color. And one got banned even for wearing a really nice outfit, a Chun-Li outfit, Street Fighter, but it had a slit so people could see her leg. And they managed to get her banned based on that, because the leg was visible and somehow that fitted that nudity clause, blah, 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 blah. So what you see a lot is that it's always the, I think, or a lot of cases, marginalized groups who will suffer because of these guidelines and who will be selected out by certain individuals. And that's really, really problematic. And we're seeing an increase of that. Pair that also with the rise of algorithms, which make it easier to ban certain content immediately from the get-go, like we saw with Tumblr, where certain things got immediately erased when they implemented a new algorithm. You see it also with hashtags, right? Yeah, it's a very problematic space that we're navigating. And yeah, it's for a good reason that a lot of people are writing on this in critical algorithm studies and show how algorithms kind of amplify oppression. So all the stereotypes you find in Google about women, persons of color, etc., they're a great example, and how Google struggles to moderate those results and fails time and time again. But also Tumblr and other platforms increasingly fit that pattern. And there's no way about it, because these are cheap, nimble business models. So at some point they need an algorithm. They often don't have the resources to keep hiring human content moderators. And even, of course, the humans make mistakes. But we're going to head into an interesting age the coming years, and it's going to get very problematic to the point that some people, for good reason, say this is the new human right crisis and we should be very attentive of what's going on here.
And there's this policing on, adult content, and queer people report being affected by this policing. There are these narratives resurfacing that try to make a link between, for example, homosexuality and pedophilia, or homosexuality and rape, and which is really not the first time we've seen this happening. Well, and I'm not trained in informatics, but I wonder how the algorithms are used or which role they play.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to imagine most technologies and things that we use, or even things like medicine, who's the default user? It's going to be a white middle class man. It's not going to be women, let alone queer women or trans women for that matter. So in a lot of cases, if you need specialized things, or if the algorithms get applied, it's going to really be targeting us. And sometimes there's even a kind of value statement behind it, right? So the fact that a soap dispenser or a door doesn't work when you're a black person, it's not just a neutral act. There's much more behind that. And it's not just a matter of testing. There's also gatekeeping and other things involved of who belongs in a space and who doesn't. And we're seeing the same thing with algorithms really in the digital space. Or an airbag not being tested for women, which is also a big thing. So it's very, very difficult. And indeed, that's where some of the STS thinking kicks in, and the things you just said, where we need to think critically about who's on the, who are we missing? Whose voice are we not hearing? And the rise of, let's say, purity culture, which you just mentioned a bit, in fandom, which is coming back in again through the back door. Yeah, it's extremely worrisome, I think. I'm deeply worried about that discourse as well. For instance, about age, it's taking really preposterous dimensions, if you ask me, as a private person. But yeah, I think it's a fascinating thing to study, obviously, but this kind of policing and gatekeeping of sexuality, of who you're going to be with, etc. It's worrisome. And indeed, some of the beauty of fandom is indeed enjoying different forms of erotica, sexuality, etc. And by really policing that space, you're also going to cause problems, I think, for people who are still finding themselves and who are queer.
Do you have an idea why it is fandom of all places where policing and purity culture reappears?
Hard one. I think we're in a kind of cultural momentum. So I don't think this is fandom alone. I think a lot of this is contextual, that if you would look at other types of user-generated content, we might see similar discussions pop up. It's a sensitive issue, I think. I think we're in a culture where we're more and more realizing consent is important, where certain things shouldn't be done. So I'm getting the feeling some of this still has to do with the momentum of Me Too and other types of movements, but then strongly reinforcing them also in spaces where it doesn't really fit, right? So let's say consent in fan fiction is important. Age difference, it shouldn't happen. It now has a bad reputation, so we should be very careful what we do. So I have the feeling that a lot of the real life political discourses and things that at the moment teenagers maybe even get taught because of these discourses, that they're wearing off on fandom. That would be my guess, at least. At the same time, though, we've seen purity movements before in fandom, so it often goes in an S-curve, where at some point we've had it, and there's a more liberal stage, but now I think we're reaching the slightly more conservative stage. I also have the feeling, but that's not something I can prove, but definitely something I saw in a few spaces, here and there, I also have the feeling it's maybe not fans who are steering the discourse. I definitely have seen on a few platforms that is also the alt-right and trolls infiltrating fan spaces. And if they're going to be very vocal in a certain space, maybe you won't indeed post about your content in the same way anymore. So I also wonder in a lot of cases, yeah, it's hard to say these days. Are we dealing with a real fan, or are we sometimes dealing with a sock puppet account that's steering conversation? And yeah, it would be really interesting to trace that a bit more with digital humanities methods, if possible. There's a very real political concern that people have, certainly in the US. And again, we are studying, I think you and I, more the English language fandom. So I think a lot of that has to really do also with where they are at this point of the culture wars. And the culture wars aren't only about left and right. They're also about whiteness. They're also about things like consent and how people in power got away with a lot of things for too long. And I think that's why some people in fandom, young people, became very sensitive to power and consent.
Tell us about a special moment in your field research.
I guess during the World Cosplay Summit, when I was in Japan and I accompanied the Dutch cosplaying team during the dry run, I should say, they got a heat stroke, one of them very badly. So she was fainting and things like this. So had to take care of those girls a bit. And that also made me realize, wow, this is such a hardcore hobby when you do it on a competitive level. And again, it's the deep summer in Japan, right? It was 42 degrees Celsius or something like that. So it was really hot. Like in the middle of the day, they had to do this dry run outside in the sun. So it was really bad. So yeah, it learned me that, yeah, not only is this a very embodied hobby, but it's also very vulnerable. Like imagine wearing these corsets and choking, which was what they were at this heat. And it was really bad. So they got quite ill. And luckily they could participate because this was a few days before the event. But yeah, it's so hardcore. And it really made me realize, yeah, this embodiment and things like this, there are real repercussions there. It takes a lot. Yeah.
Name a theorist you would rather watch a YouTube tutorial than read their book.
Deleuze, I think. Yeah, Jesus, help me understand what you mean, please. And I love reading his work, but then I go out and I think, man, am I stupid? I still didn't get it totally. So that's definitely someone I read a lot of. Other people explaining Deleuze to me, podcasts of Deleuze, that sort of stuff. And then I pick up the book again, you know, in an informed way. But that would be great. I think we should do a crowdfunding campaign and raise him from the dead. Yeah.
Let's talk about online and offline. Where do you see the differences between online and offline, or do you see any differences at all?
I mean, back when I wrote Productive Fandom, I was quite optimistic. And why was I optimistic about, you know, the differences are moi. The reason I said that was also because people were really hyping virtual spaces as something fundamentally different from the offline. And I really didn't believe they were. They bleed over into each other, right? People often know each other online, have their Facebook groups, have their WhatsApp groups, have little things, and then see each other at a convention, right? So today in this heavy mediated society, even more so during COVID, I think that doesn't really hold ground. But I do think it really matters what platform you study, right? I think it's something fundamentally different to study WhatsApp or Facebook versus Twitch versus YouTube, blah, blah, blah. So I think we need not one virtual ethnography. I think we need different methods for these different platforms that we think through very carefully. So in that sense, maybe that's, again, not that different from online, offline fields where, you know, there's also differences in terms of access, barriers, language, etc. These type of things are still there in virtual ethnography. But today, and increasingly so, platforms become more complex and have their own different cultures. And that also relates back to their purpose, the way in which we communicate on them, the affordances and options we have on them. Yeah, I started kind of downplaying the differences a bit also as a critique of that literature from the 2000s, right? And I wanted to do something different, right? I wanted to stress this is still a very human thing. These online technologies are not something different. We all use them. There's a real similarity to how people use it. But my understanding shifted when we moved more and more to these big private platforms. And of course, that was already in the making when I wrote Productive Fandom, but it's been increasing. And it's been increasing also partly because, yeah, many of us aren't using things like Tumblr, LiveJournal, etc., these type of systems anymore, or private forums. We're using the big things, and they rely on tagging, they rely on algorithms, the things we just discussed. And those are things where I think the inherent difference is. So I think for me, yeah, the big difference now would be if you'd ask me, we're in a data-driven participatory culture. It's changing rapidly. Our data, our content is being monetized. So we're in these different contexts. It's not us who monetize the content usually, unless we're the big influencers, but it's YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, who profit. So it's a business model for them, not for us. And that platform economy, that data-driven participatory culture is where I think the big difference is. And that's something I've been writing a bit about lately and working on more. So platform fandom, because I don't think we're in Henry Jenkins's participatory culture anymore. I think we've moved to a very different data-driven participatory culture where we have different norms, different ways of structuring information and content, where fandom is much more fractured. So yes, there will be idiots on Twitter policing your fan fiction because it's being made very easy for them and we don't have these dedicated platforms anymore, or at least not all of us are using them anymore in the same way. So we're seeing conflict in a lot of these spaces. And some of this indeed has to do with anonymity, like you said, or the fact that, you know, we can use take advantage of these platforms for trolling and being someone else. But I think some of it also has to do with how loose these connections are. These are all super, 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 super weak ties in a participatory culture where we increasingly don't want to hold each other accountable and where we increasingly have different values and norms. And this, again, goes back a little bit to the culture wars as well. We have different political stances, maybe, and sometimes they conflict in fandom. And that's where things go out of hand. in our work, I think a turn is needed. So I'm working more on that. But I think, yeah, the data of fans, the content we make, it's not neutral. It's not a happy fandom is beautiful space, but it's increasingly part of a political and business landscape, really. And yeah, that also probably means we need new ethnographies suited for different platforms and with a more data-driven angle.
I think fandom is also a great place to study emotions, because fans are very emotional. Their language is very emotional. I would say they have their own emotional language.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the part about emotion, I think you're very right about your observation there. I think fans are effective audiences, right? They do effective reception. They're not just any audience. They care about what they do. They feel something. That feeling obviously can also be a bit anti or negative, but emotions are a very real part of this equation. So they're not the typical rational, passive, critical reader we had in mind in literary studies for ages, but there's something else. And that also shows us that people receive fiction in highly personal and emotional and effective ways. And it's really good to go through that and think about what that means. And that's also maybe the downside of a fandom, which is what we're seeing a bit right now, the rise of movements like QAnon, alt-right, anti-vaccine, etc. Also emotional audiences, right? Also a bit akin to fandom, also doing a lot of content creation, can almost be interpreted like a kind of fandom. And that's because of this emotional baggage. And that can get exploited on social media sometimes. And not always for the good. Not always for the good. Like the other examples you just gave, right, which were a bit more about the purity culture. But I do think there's a maybe even a weakness there that we're seeing being exploited today. So I think when we're studying effective reception, that's also something we should be mindful of, the fact that all of this is going on and that, you know, it's sometimes mobilized, but not for the best purposes.
It's interesting that you mentioned QAnon. I think the difference might be that fans are reflective when it comes to their emotions. Sometimes I think there's strategy. So, for example, you tweet things like, I'm sad, does anyone have a fluffy fan fiction or new pictures of my favorite actor, things like that.
Yeah, I like that. And it checks out with what I found on fans, indeed, that it's a process affect and fans can construct affect. So they aim to feel things in a certain way by doing things in a cosplay that they engage with closely, or shipping and reading about that fic again and again and again to relive an emotion. So they are not the type of affect we sometimes hear about in Deleuzian writing, right, where it's all very fluffy and ontological, etc. No, they are very deliberate consumers, indeed strategic, like you say, who know what kind of emotion they're looking for and will mobilize that and will look for that and will try to relive that by replaying what makes them feel comfortable or happy, or by indeed funneling some of their emotion through hating something, right? So I agree with you that that the deliberate angle is maybe the big difference there. But I meant more like when people have these emotions, what we're seeing now in the cultural momentum is that if they're not reflexive, I guess, they're also a bit vulnerable. And that's what some of these movements prey upon, I guess. But of course, they also pair it with, like, I also wonder how many of them really believe it, or are just after the sensation of it. This idea of, oh, there might be something mysterious going on with the U.S. government. So it fits a long line of conspiracy thinking. This is by no means new. And that also is a sensation on its own right, I think.
If you had research funds for 6 years, what would you do?
Oh my God, I would love that. Well, 6 years, man. I do definitely the platform fandom book. Hoppakee, great. I'd get some PhDs in to explore different angles of these different questions. Maybe one on something like sustainability by herself or himself or themselves. I'd love to work, I think, with a very inclusive team, different backgrounds, do a really good ethnography with me. And maybe even explore also that line we just talked about. What would these new forms of ethnography look like in a digital and offline age? Like, can we also offer something maybe method-wise? So something that isn't just, you know, a fan studies or media culture question, but more broadly can educate cultural studies and social scientists on how you can do virtual ethnography in cool ways. So I would explore, I think, these different lines together with a team. Yeah, because there's no way I can do that alone only, and I shouldn't. So I like the idea of collaborating more.
Which advice would you give every student with an interest in fan studies?
Join us and bring your insights, because we're a new field. We can still learn a lot. We're not a hardcore discipline, right? We're a branch of media studies and cultural studies. When you join us, read our work critically, position it in the context that we were working in, right, where we had to fight back and show studies on fans are not something trivial, right? I was the first in the Netherlands, other than Inang, to publish on fans. And, you know, I had to push back so much. You will run into those fights. So that might make you also sensitive to, oh, fandom is subversive, fandom is something radically different. But as you go further in your PhD or your research, try to rise above what we have now. Look at the latest fan studies and counter that idea. I would say that participation is by default neutral, positive, democratic, all the things we just said, or global, because it is always reflect a certain culture, politics, ideology, hierarchy, and we're seeing more and more of that today. So be sensitive to the cultural tensions in this.
We talked about fan discourse and harassment, and well, I think fans are sensitive right now. To me, some fans describe fandom as a sort of safe space. And as a researcher, of course, I'm worried about ruining that safe space, because people might feel stressed or anxious with me being there. In every field, you have to learn the language, the rules, how to behave. But I think it's more difficult in the digital space. It's more difficult to discern whether it's a private space or a public space. Am I entering unknowingly a safe space? And our traditional understanding of private and public doesn't fit for places like this anymore.
No, not at all. Not at all. No. I think that's a really interesting thing you're already saying, because I would agree with that. And I think what you see in the Association for Internet Researcher Guidelines, so AIR, the big society, they always have ethical guidelines and they renew them all the time. And they also move more and more to kind of statement on degrees of privacy with a few tips, right? To check for consent, to keep checking up, to also get a sense of, do I feel this is vulnerable or private, right? So to do some checking yourself, because sometimes a fan might also not similar ideas you have. Indeed, how public or private is the thing you're studying? I'm more relaxed with, let's say, things like YouTube or Twitch, which are content channels, I would call them, right? They're more to watch, to enjoy. So I treat those more like a media text. Do I sometimes also feel hesitant with that? Because some of these have very few viewers, maybe don't know I'm studying them, even though it's in my profile, that sort of stuff. So should I announce myself? What should I do? And I think if you're only doing superficial content analysis, it's fine. But the minute you're sorting something out as a bigger example, it really helps to ask for permission, to check with people. You worry about ruining spaces. You know, I don't really believe in that because, in a sense, what is your duty as an ethnographer? It's to, unless you're being instructed to lurk, which can happen with the more corporate ethnographies, but unless that's what you've been asked to do, it's about being open to your informants. It's about creating a constructed dialogue. It's about participating. It's about being able to voice also what a community is feeling. And I think that's the most important task of an ethnographer. And that's also why the right follow-ups for bigger projects are so essential. Like, don't just do ethnography or content analysis, but follow up with some interviews, follow up with some focus groups, ask people, can I study your tweet or your fan fiction in more detail, or your stream or your vlog? So, you know, see it as a step up. And you can't ask everyone for consent on something like Twitter, right? So to an extent, you have to be, I think, you do have to treat things as public, but I think be sensitive. If it's a more private tweet, or if there's a picture of someone and you clearly see this was meant to be for a smaller group of fans than their general audience, because they're mixing public and private, and I think we all do that, then be gracious. Because no one is thinking, like, you don't think about your Twitter account like, ooh, if I'm not posting this on my publicly open Twitter, this one selfie, people might do blah, blah, blah. You're not thinking like, you're more like, oh, I want to share the experience of my life during COVID or something like that. So think about the purpose of stuff and be gracious. And if you can then ask people to voice an experience in their own words, that's really important. I think the last thing you want to do is deprive people of their narrative. So I actually see participation and being purposeful in ethnography as a really important thing. But be strategic. You can do it all. You can't ask thousands of tweets that you're potentially distant reading to all give you an idea of what they're feeling. But once you're really shaping a narrative, be sure that you get different impressions in, because your understanding or interpretation might not be the one that fans have. And I've found this so often with, yeah, different things I studied, whether it's cosplay or Lego fans or whatever. People have come at it from different cultures, different life experiences, different narratives. There's often something behind why they're posting something that you don't know, that you can't see. So yeah, keep that conversation going. And yeah, when it's about the big platforms like YouTube, maybe don't overthink it too much. You know, that famous influencer won't reply to you, but you have to make sure that whatever you're posting kind of represents the experience of being a fan of that person or that person themselves.
That leaves me with only one question left. What are you currently working on, and what are your future projects?
So I've just finished a piece on agency in fan studies, which also unpacks some of these networks that you've been asking about, some of these systems and ontologies. That's going to be published in a German book by Klaus Sachs-Humbach and Lukas Wilde from Tübingen University. Agency Post-Digital, I think it's called. And very importantly, I'm working more and more on sustainability in fandom. So some more readings will come out on that in different books. So that's really the recent stuff I've been working on, which is also really about fandom and the environment and sustainability studies. And it's not something you hear a lot about in fandom, sadly. But luckily, more and more people are questioning their collections, their merchandise, the plastics that they're consuming, what they're using for their cosplays, because most cosplayers wear an outfit once and that's it. So it's a really not a great and sustainable way of doing fandom. So more and more conversations are popping up also about environmentally friendly fandom. And I really want to tie in with that and maybe even take a bit of a fan activist stance myself, because I think this is something extremely important. We don't have that much time anymore on this planet. So this is, in my opinion, even more than AI and data, which I already think are really bad problems, the racism, etc. But sustainability for sure is one we didn't touch upon yet, and that keeps me up at night, you know, as someone who is pretty green. So I might want to combine that even with a bit of, you know, autoethnography activism, panels at conventions in due time. Yeah.
Nicole, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you about fandom, affordances, networks, platforms. I'm looking forward to read about your upcoming projects. And yes, thank you, dear listeners, for listening to our podcast.
Das war Feinfühlig. Das Kolloquium zum Hören am Institut für Kulturanthropologie und Europäische Ethnologie in Freiburg.